The Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah states, Tav Tezayin Amar Aleph, B'arba Prokim O'ilam Nidon. There are four times during the year when the world is judged. The Pesach Al HaTvur. Pesach is a judgment for Tvur. Ba'atzeres and Shavuos Al Peiros Ha'ilim, and fruits of the tree. B'Rosh Hashanah Kol Boy Oilam Oivrim Lefon of Kivnei Moron. We'll see what Kivnei Moron means. The whole world passes in front of the Rabbeinu Shel Oilam. Shenemar Ayetzer Yachad Libob HaBevin Okol Ma'aseyim. And that's Rosh Hashanah. The Rabbeinu Shel Oilam examines that which we do. Uvechag and Ansukas is Nidonim Alamayim. So, it's interesting. The Gemara is not sure exactly what the Mishnah means when it says Rosh Hashanah Koboy Oilam Oivrim Lefonov Kivnei Moron. We are all familiar really with the first pshat of the Gemara. That's the one, but there are actually three pshatim in the Gemara. My Kivnei Moron. Hocha Targima on Bovel, they explain this Kivnei Morono, like sheep. And as Rashi says, when they count the sheep to take the Maisa Behemoth, the tithe of the Behemoth, they go out one by one. Pesach Kotten, it's a narrow door, so only one at a time could go. And every tenth one, we know that they mock, they make a simon on it, and that's the Maisa Behemoth. So it's a doorway from one corral to the next. And it's only wide enough to accommodate one animal. So each one passes by himself. The message being that we can't disappear in the crowd. You had to finish his tests exactly on time. You couldn't finish 2 seconds late. They wouldn't take your paper. So one fine day, a guy took a few extra minutes to finish the test, and he comes up, and the teacher glares at him. And the guy says to the teacher, "Do you know who I am?" And the teacher says, "I don't care who you are." "Yes, again, do you know who I am?" "I don't care." He says it a third time. "You know who I am?" He says, "I haven't the foggiest idea, and I don't want to know." He says, "Very good." He takes his paper and he stuffs it into the middle of a pile of completed papers on the desk, and he runs out. But he disappeared in the crowd. So the Mishnah is coming to tell us that that trick is not going to work on Rosh Hashanah. On Rosh Hashanah, we take a lonely walk. We appear by ourselves before the Rabbeinu Shel Oilam. We'll come back to, we invoke somewhat Zchus HaRabim, so that does help a little bit. But at the end of the day, we still have to stand on our own merits. That's the first explanation. Rish Lakish Omar, Kamalos Beis Moron. And as Rashi explains, what does Kamalos Beis Moron mean? Haderach Kotzer, it's a very narrow path. It cannot accommodate two people standing side by side. There's a cliff on each side of the road. So it's a narrow mountain fall, enough to accommodate one person. If a second guy tries to get there, someone's going down. So it only so again, you have to go one by one. And finally, Rabbi Yehuda Omar Shmuel, Ki Chayoloi Shel Beis David. As the soldiers of Dovid HaMelech, Ukivnei Moron, Kivnei Chayoloi Shel Melech, like the members of the units of the army, Moroin Loshin Maras for Adnus, that you have a master. The king is the master. They counted the soldiers as they went out one by one. So, the Gemara is a very, very difficult Gemara to understand. The notion that we're trying to articulate that we are judged individually is a very simple notion. You don't have to be sophisticated and you feel a philosophical or logical understanding to figure that out. It's very simple. And yet we have three explanations, and the Gemara feels it's important to record all three. I mean, what would it be if the Gemara recorded one of them? We'd get the message. What's the difference? The first one, the second one, the third one. They all deliver the same message. It's a very simple and straightforward message. So we have to have three opinions, and the Shas feels it's important to present all three opinions for a notion which is utterly simple. A very difficult Gemara. So in this Gemara, Rabbi Yisrael of Salant, Rabbi Yisrael Salant had three very, very great disciples. Rav Simcha Zissel of Kelum, Rav Nafali Amsterdam, and Rav Itzela Petterberger. And Rav Itzela was renowned besides being a great disciple of Rav Yisrael. He was also renowned. He was a phenomenal Talmud Chacham. We have Shilas and Shuvah Sefer that he wrote, Pri Yitzchak. He was a phenomenal, he was renowned as a phenomenal Goyim. So, he is the one that published the Or Yisrael, the collected writings of Rabbi Yisrael Salanta. And in that work, he also appended some of his own insights in a separate section. And he dwells on this Gemara, and he says the point of this Gemara, in fact, is that all three of these explanations are complementary. And what is the point of this Gemara? So he points to a Gemara earlier in Rosh Hashanah. This is on Daf Yud Ches, on Daf Ches Amar Aleph, we find the Gemara, which says the following. That on Rosh Hashanah, that if a melech and hedyet, if it is a time to judge either a king or a commoner, the king is judged before the commoner in Shemayim. Why? Because the fate of the king will affect an entire nation. The fate of the individual will affect himself. You know, there was a Satmar Chassid once. I heard this once one year in the Sukkah. He paid, I think, $20,000 and he bought Nafta Yoyo. So he went to the Rebbe, the Divrei Yoyo Zatzal, and he wanted to be Mechabed the Divrei Yoyo with the Aliyah. So the Divrei Yoyo, the Rav Yoyo Zatzal said to him, he says, tell me, why do you want me to take the Aliyah? In other words, if he wanted it so that he should be able to tell the whole world he was Mechabed the Rebbe, the Rebbe was going to tell him no thanks. So he was a very smart guy, this Chassid. So he said to the Rebbe the following, that if I'll take the Aliyah, I'll get a bracha. But if the Rebbe takes the Aliyah, the whole Kehillah will get a bracha, because you're the Rebbe of the whole Kehillah. So the Rebbe liked the answer, and he accepted. So it's really the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah. Melech v'hedyet, so the Melech gets judged. Why do we judge him first? So the Gemara says, because mikodem the leifa ishcharon af, before the midas hadin becomes too ascendant, as the sinners pass before the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, and the world is judged hands on to be a more sinful place, so the midas hadin is strengthened, and therefore it's important that the melech should go earlier, so he has a greater amount of midas harachamim. And therefore, that will be to the benefit of his entire nation. So Rav Itzela Petterberger deduces from this that what we should endeavor to do is to be judged as early as possible on Rosh Hashanah. But the question is how we get there. You know, you can't exactly go online, you know, in the Ticketron and buy a ticket, you know, to get to the first, you know, the first group that's going in, you know, an airplane, you know, you can buy first class, they'll let you go in right away. But you can't buy a ticket on Ticketron. So how do you get to the front of the line? He says, that's the question that the Mishnah is addressing. And he says, there are three ways to get to the front of the line. two of them are not particularly relevant, as we'll see, and one is very critical. The ones that are not particularly relevant, he says, the most famous Reb Shotem, Kivnei Maron, like the sheep approaching the opening, the doorway from one corral to the next to be counted. He says, so let me ask you, he says, which sheep go first and which go last? How does it work? The answer is very simple. The strongest, most robust ones push the other ones to the side and they go first. The herd mentality. The weaker ones are pushed to the side and they can go only go when they're strong enough to vie for their place. So he says, this is representative of the tzaddikim, the great saints of each generation. So he says, that's not our problem. If we're one of the saints, we're one of them. And most of us are not one of those saints, so it's really not relevant to us. That's not our problem when the saints are judged. So let's put that one to the side, he says. Then he said, is kichayolo shobeis David. As the soldiers and the units march forth to battle, if you observe, he said, how a battle takes place, I'll put it in more modern terms, just to make it more contemporary, but the point is, it's true throughout all of history. I remember particularly the lead up to the first Gulf War. Right? So General Schwarzkopf was the general of 500,000 United States forces. And so what went on for a week, 2-3 weeks before the war? The units were moving all over the place. They were moving east, they were moving west, they were moving north. They were all over. They were constantly in motion. When he struck 100 miles away from where anyone else anticipated that he would strike. So what was all the movement? You ask any soldier, why are you being moved here? You're being moved. Nobody knows. So the general said, I have to go there. The orders are to go there. No one has the foggiest notion except the general of why the troops are being moved where they are. He is involved in a massive deception, which succeeded handsomely. The soldier, you ask him, well, why are you going? I don't know. The officer told me to go. Well, I don't know. I'm the foggiest. I don't know what it means. He said, there are those, we say in Parshas Kisisa v'chanosi asashar achon v'richamti asashar arachem. There are those that merit kindness from the Rebbeinu Shel Olam, and it's inscrutable. We have no understanding of why it's the case, why this person, what he did, or his grandfather did, his great-grandfather, or is some descendant of his is going to do. It's inscrutable. Rebbeinu Shel Olam has some cheshbon that's totally out of our grasp of why this person merits a special nesias chayim, a special grace, if we could use that word, in our religion. A special grace before the Rebbeinu Shel Olam. So he says, again, that's not particularly relevant to us. If we're one of those people that's on that list, so we're in good shape, we'll also get in early to the Mishpat. And if we're not, we can't put ourselves on that list. He says, but there's one that's particularly relevant to us. He says, and that's the interpretation, Kamaila Space Moron. As the people attempting to pass through a narrow mountain pass that's enough to accommodate one person at a time as he climbs through the peaks of the mountains. He says, how do we determine who goes first in that situation? It's very simple. He says, you go to the post office in the morning. There's a line. Who goes first? The guy that got there first goes first. You come half an hour later in the back of the line. The same thing, you come to the mountain pass, the guy that got there first said, nobody could push, it's not a place to push. If you push, it's all over for all of you. So that's it, whoever got there first goes first. The second guy goes second, he said. So this is relevant to us. So we need to arrive at the Mishpat, to be involved in the Mishpat as early as possible. So how do we get involved in the Mishpat? Says if we become cognizant of the impending Mishpat of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and we begin in our own lives to deal with it, says then we're already online, we're already involved in the Mishpat. So what did, as a Talmud of Rav Yisrael of Salant, so what did he suggest we do? He says that we should begin learning Musar from the beginning of Chodesh Elul. And then we're involved with the Mishpat. We've acknowledged the Mishpat, it's coming, and it's, you know, you see sometimes, you know, that they have the World Series is coming, right? So people want tickets, and they camp out outside, you know, for days on end outside, you know, the stadium until they can get a ticket. So if you come and you're cognizant of the mishpat and you're preparing for the mishpat, so you're online. So he says, that's what we need to do. We need to start to learn Musar. Now, the problem is that in the age in which we live, almost no one understands what Musar is. If I ask what's the definition of Musar, whatever answer I would receive, they're all partially true and partially untrue. Say, Musar is when you get up and you rebuke someone and you put him in his place, you gave him Musar. It's, you know, that's true in a certain regard. You know, Musar in the Torah is translated as to teach, not really to rebuke. It's Musar Hashem Elokeichem is the teachings of the Rabbeinu Shalom. But we missed the point. That's not the essence of what Musar is, what Rav Yisrael wanted. It was so striking to me. You know, it was a chisi to live with Rav Henoch, who was a tzal, the Rosh Yeshiva of Chofetz Chaim. I lived with him for 3 years in the house. And the way he defined Musar, his personal definition of Musar, he could sit down to learn Musar sometimes, and the whole world was flying around, and he'd take out a Musar sefer, and he was oblivious to the world, and sit and learn Musar, has to learn Musar now. And how did he define Musar? In a very, very unusual way. But a very telling way, and it was a very big bombusar. He said, Musar is to be a human being. The essence, what makes a human human, is the ability to think. If we don't stop to think, he said, then we're not exercising our humanity. So, what we need, Musar, is just to stop to think, to get off the merry-go-round. Just stand on the side for a few minutes, stop the world, and just stop to think, get our bearings, what we're about, what am I doing, where am I going? You know, there was a big rov in Eretz Yisrael, Shum Shum Pinkas, died tragically in an accident. So he said, he described life in Eretz Yisrael. You know, in life in Eretz Yisrael, there are thousands of people that are in Kailo. He says he can get up 5 o'clock in the morning, run to Davin Kivasikin at the first minyan at the crack of dawn, come home, run off, get the kids to school, run to Koila, learn a whole day, be busy learning till midnight, go to sleep. And he didn't once think about the Rabbeinu Shalom. The Rabbeinu Shalom didn't fit into the day. Okay. We need just sometimes just to stop to think what we're doing, where we're running, why we're doing, what I'm doing, where I'm trying to go. And as the Navi says, it's like the cavalry, the horse that charges into battle. It's the rider whips it and it puts its head down and it just goes. Oblivious to everything around it. So Musar is to engage our intellectual capacity, to focus it, just where we are, where we're going, what we're doing. That's the way he used to define Musar. Just to stop to think. Put on the brakes and stop to think once in a while, what I want in this world, what I'm trying to do. So that's the nature of what we talk about by Musar. And that's really the preparation for Rosh Hashanah, is to appreciate the gift of life that the Rabbeinu Shalom has given us and to ask ourselves what I'm going to do with it. What am I out to do? You know, one of the most pathetic things, it's very interesting. The world of advertising is a very interesting place. So, I don't know, every once in a while they come out, they have these ads for Mount Sinai Hospital about how advanced the medicine in Mount Sinai Hospital is. They used to run them a lot at CBS. Every once in a while they bring them back again for a while and they fade out, they come again. So they talked about a guy that had some cardiac problem, whatever, and if he'd gone elsewhere, who knows what would have happened with him, but he came to Mount Sinai and they knew how to fix him up. And the guy is like 93 years old, I think. And what does he have to express? What's his jubilation that he came through this process and he's healthy again? He can go to more Yankee games. He can go to more Yankee games. That's, you know. So, there is, it was expressed in another way, Rav Michal Twersky, Shlito of Milwaukee, expressed it in this fashion. Had a famous story. He said the story happened by the Berkotzka Rebbe. The Chidush HaRim was a Talmud of the Kotzka Rebbe, and he decided he wants to go to Kotzk in Poland, to go to Kotzk for Rosh Hashanah. But he lived very far from Kotzk, so he set off by foot. He was poor, indigent. He set off, and he set off. He's going to travel to Kotzk. Take him a month's time, whatever it is, but he's going to be better Rebbe for Yontov. Well, he's going and going and going, and it's the last number of days before Yontov, and he realizes that he's just too far away. If he keeps going the way he's going, he's not going to arrive in Kotzk. So what does he do? So he goes, and he gets himself a balagola, a wagon driver. So the wagon driver looks at this guy, looks down and out, and he's afraid he's going to take this guy for a drive. And at the end of the ride, the guy's not going to have money to pay him. So what did he do? So he promises him, he says, in Kotzka I have a lot of friends. And they'll put the money together and they'll pay him. And he gauged that he was a sincere person of integrity. So the Balagola undertook it. So he gets in the wagon and the Balagola sets off. And they're traveling. They're still a good distance. It's close, it's Erev Rosh Hashanah, almost the night of Erev Rosh Hashanah, and they're still a good distance from Kotzk. And so the Chidush HaRim implores the Balagola to drive the horses faster. They drive the horse faster. We've got to get to Kotzk in time. And the Balagola whips the horse, and he drives the horse, and finally, Erev Rosh Hashanah in the afternoon, he arrives in Kotzk. Chidush HaRim runs and goes his Chaver Mikotsk, pays the Balagola, and then tragedy strikes. The horse dies. From the overexertion of the trip, the horse petered out and died. And this shattered the Balagola. This was his whole panosa, was this horse. Now what's he going to do? So out of the shock, he also died. He gets a heart attack and he dies. So they start Rosh Hashanah, and come to Musaf, and the Chidush HaRim is davening interminably. And in the middle of Musaf, he's bawling like a baby. He's crying and crying and crying and crying. And his Chaverim look at him. This was not his style of tefillah. And they looked at him, and finally finishes Shemoneh Esrei, and he indicates, after the tefillah, I'll tell you what it was all about. So they finished davening. And his Chaverim come to ask him, what was this all about? What took place? He says, let me tell you what took place, he says. While in the midst of Shemoneh Esrei, I had a vision of the mishpat, of the judgment of this Balagola. Okay? Before the Rebbeinu Shalom. So, they said, no. They said, he was a person, he had no association with learning, he wasn't, you know, very learned, he wasn't super observant, you know, minimally, but he wasn't a class A Jew. So, you know, how can we let him into Gan Eden? But the Malachim came and said, listen, he died serving a Talmud Chacham, so that should be a schus for him. So the Bezin Shalmaila convened again, and they said, you know, he's right. They're right. He died serving a Talmud Chacham. He deserves to get into Gan Eden. Okay. So now they had a new Shaila. What Gan Eden are they going to give him? Are they going to sit him next to the Vilna Gaon? Well, no, it's a big Gehenim for him. The Vilna Gaon will be talking and learning without the foggiest idea what the Vilna Gaon is talking about. So where are they going to put him? What are they going to do with him? So the Bezin Shemaila convened again. What's the Gan Eden we're going to give him? So they came to the conclusion, what's the Gan Eden we can give him? They gave him a brand new wagon. Moses Montefiore would have been envious of it. 6 of the finest steeds the world has ever seen. and they sat him on it, and he whipped the horses, and he went off the Netzach Mitzach to his eternal reward on an endless highway. So the Chiddush HaRim said, I cried from the Gan Eden of a Yid. That's what I cried from. That's all he could be zeichet to. He says, that's why I cried. You know, we need to ask ourselves, Elulis, to ask ourselves what we want, what it's all about, for what. You know, the essential difference between an animal and a human being is really consciousness. In our perception, which is, I believe to be true, animals don't really have consciousness. He gets up and he grazes, he sleeps, he grazes more, and that's it. You know, we have consciousness. We're aware of what's going on around us. We need to ask ourselves, for what am I living? What do I hope to accomplish in life? And that's really, that's what Musar is. Musar is just to ask ourselves those questions and to focus on it. To focus on it. This we read in Parshas Ekev, Goya Ekev Tishmon. So Ekev is an unusual word. Ekev is an unusual word. Goya Ekev Tishmon means as a result of our listening to the mitzvahs. So the Rabbanu Shalom will bless us with the Eretz Yisrael. But Ekev is a word we don't find too many times at Chumash. We find it in the Akedah. I believe we find the Ekev Hashem Avram B'Koyli. But Ekev is a very, very uncommon word used in Chumash. And according to the Ayah of Chazal, what's the meaning of the word Ekev? So Chazal tell us, Oya Ekev Tishmon, means Elu Dvorim. Ekev also has a meaning of a heel. His voya Ekev Tishmon is an allusion to the heel. These are the mitzvahs that we tread upon, just as we go along. We just tread upon them. We don't pay any attention to them. So if one observes these mitzvahs, even these mitzvahs, will be zoicha to Eretz Yisrael. So why are we doshba kevav? We're not dealing with a person that doesn't believe, and then he does a lot worse than Dosh Ba'akevav. Right? He's openly defiant of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Reb Chaim of Brisk used to come out Shabbos to go to Shul in Brisk. And there was a young man who was a real Ahachas. So he used to go and greet the Rav every Shabbos smoking a cigarette. Some other time we'll talk about what Reb Chaim did for him later. Reb Chaim went to unusual lengths to help him. But when we talk about Voya Ekev Tishmon, so we're not dealing with a person that's lahachas, a person that doesn't care about the mitzvahs. Pshat is we don't focus on the mitzvahs. There are mitzvahs that we don't focus upon. We don't do them not because if we bothered to focus upon them, we would do something about them. We just don't focus upon them. They're not enough. So Rabbi Saul of Salant used to cite a Gemara in Menachos. And it was a very powerful lesson he had from it. The Gemara in Menachos talks about the fact that the tzitzis is one of the subjects which is discussed in the Sechta Menachos. And it has two components. We have the white strands and the bluish strands, the tchelis. Right? So the bluish ones, at some point in history, went out of vogue for whatever reason. That's a schmooze for another day. But they went out of vogue. But when they existed, so the Gemara says that if a person did not put in the tchelis, so he would be punished by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But if he didn't put in the white tzitzis, he would have an even greater punishment. Why? Not because one is a bigger mitzvah than the other. They're both the same mitzvah. But the tchelis, he has an excuse why he didn't put it in. The tchelis was expensive. And we find, in fact, that since it was expensive, whenever there's an expense that's involved in something, there's someone that will produce a fraudulent product to take its place that's cheaper. So there were those that wanted to be known for their piety, that they observed the mitzvah properly, but they didn't have any intention of spending the money they had to get the tchelis, which was made from some type of shellfish. So what did they do? They had dye, which was made from a tree, and the dye was the same color as the tchelis. So they would dye that tzitzis with what's called chloylon, coloring from a tree. So the tchelis was expensive. So if a person didn't do the tchelis, he has some measure of answer. It's not a full answer, but listen, Rabbeinu Shalom, there was a lot of money involved. It wasn't so comfortable to spend so much money. Is it going to get him off the hook? No, it won't get him off the hook, but it's at least a reason that he didn't do it. He wasn't willful. But a person that didn't put in the white strands, I mean, what did the white strands cost? The white strands, you could take any threads almost and make tzitzis out of them. Right, there's the famous incident at the end of the Second World War, when the Klosenberger Rebbe, Zatzal, was freed in Feldofing, so the Americans came around and they gave out, you know, fresh clothes and linen to the people to survive those horrendous circumstances. So it was in the middle of the week. Friday night, the Klosenberger Rebbe showed up to lead the tefillahs, and he had a talus. Now, where in the world did the Klosenberger Rebbe get a talus 3 days after the war ended in a DP camp? He took a sheet that he got from the American forces. He unraveled, he took off some of the threads from the edge. He unraveled them, the threads, and then he put them back together with his fingers, spun them back together. So they did tefillah lishma, it was spun lishma. And then from that he made tzitzis. He made the sheet into a talus. And he made tzitzis, instead of lishma, and he had kosher tzitzis. So it's no big deal to make tzitzis, white tzitzis. So the Gemara says that's the reason that if a person is not observant, doesn't observe the white tzitzis, he's going to have a harder time before the Rebbeinu Shalom. Because what in the world did you do? You know, if you were challenged, it's one thing. There was no challenge involved in this. So you know, Yisrael of Salant drew a major credo from this. That what is most significant before the Rabbeinu Shalom? We know there are different levels of kapar. There are what we might say relatively minor averus, and there are major averus. We have the famous brisa that the Rif quotes, right? The four levels of kapar. So from a person there's a mitzvah sasei, more stringent than that is a mitzvah lo sasei. That there's a mitzvah sasei that has kares, one that has mitzvah bezdin. So each one reflects the seriousness of the punishment, reflects a greater gravity of that avera. But within each realm of avera, where will HaKadosh Baruch Hu take us most to task? He says, you know where? For the things that we readily could have done. They're going to ask us, why in the world didn't you do this? You know, you ask me why I didn't learn 20 hours a day. Listen, Rabbeinu Shalom, it was, maybe I should have, but it was mighty hard. But why didn't you bother to make a bracha when you ate a fruit? What am I going to say if I did that avera? So if we have averas that were easy to clean up and we didn't clean them up, we're in trouble. So that's the averas why that Shalom Dosh Ba'akevav. The reason we violate them is not because we don't want to do them. If we just paid attention, we would do something about them. We just didn't pay attention. We just didn't stop to be aware of what's going on around us. So he says, he suggests that in each realm of our deficiencies, we should first address the things that are easiest to clean up. He says, we'll clean up most of the mess. The more difficult challenges, listen, we'll come before the Rabbeinu Shalom and we'll look for a plea bargain. Rabbeinu Shalom, listen, this was a mighty hard nisayon, you know. If I got upset at my mother-in-law this year, if you had a mother-in-law like that, Rabbeinu Shalom, I don't know if you wouldn't get upset either, you know? So listen, is it an excuse? No, but there's some merit to it. So, you know, we can plea bargain. But the things that are simple to do, we can't plea bargain. So those Rabbi Saul says, we better clean them up. We better put them in order before Rosh Hashanah comes. So that's really what we need to do. We need to stop and think in Elul. Like, what are the things that I could easily do if I just bothered to pay a little bit more attention to it? And this was a major, major teaching. It's a problem in life. To go forward in anything, we have to focus. Without focus, we can't get any place. But focus has its own dangers. Because we become so focused that we don't see anything outside our focus. So life is somewhat a trick, on one hand to be focused, and on the other hand to maintain an awareness of everything else that's going on around us. This was a major teaching of the Altar of Slobodka, one of his biggest teachings. There's a story which happened. There's a Rosh Yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael in Tifrach. His name is Rabbi Aviezer Pilz. So I heard this story. He learned the Chavrusa with Rav Moshe Chodesh, the Chavrusas. And Rav Moshe Chodesh told me this Maisa, and I discussed it later on with a son-in-law of Rabbi Aviezer Pilz, his son. The father of Rav Aviezer Pilz lived in Lodz in Poland. That's where he was from. And he went off from Lodz in Poland to Lita to study in Slobodka Yeshiva. I don't know, a year, 2 years, something. He went to Slobodka. And he came home for Sukkot. Now, Lodz was a city of big buildings. And consequently, they didn't have, in a lot of places, they had big communal sukkahs. They didn't have private sukkahs. There were big buildings. They just couldn't tell you, have a big building with 50 tenants and all Jews. What are you going to do? Have 50 private sukkahs? So you make a huge communal sukkah. So they had huge communal sukkahs. So the first night of Yontif, he was about 20, 21 years old. Chassidish fellow. When he was schmoozing with his friends after they finished the meal, they were schmoozing in the sukkah. All of a sudden he looks up and he sees this elderly man standing outside in the shadows of the sukkah. So Pilz's father turns to his chaverim and he says, listen, you know, I think we're disturbing this man. I don't know why, but we've got to get out of here. And they told him, what are you talking about? You're making up things out of whole cloth. You talk to the guy, you know anything, you know, leave us alone. So they started schmoozing another wall. Another wall goes by and again he looks up. And he sees that this old man is still standing outside in the shadows of the sukkah. So this time he turns to his chaverim and he's insistent. We've got to get out of this sukkah. No way we're staying here. We're bothering this man. I don't know why, but out we got to go. So he was insistent. So his friends agreed they're going to leave. But they weren't going to give him a free pass. Not. They went out and they decided they're going to look through the cracks in the wall in the sukkah to see what happens. They're going to see, you know. So no sooner had they marched out than this old man marches into the sukkah. He sits down, he opens up a little package of food, and what does he have inside? He has a piece of challah and a piece of herring. That's what he has. So they realized it was embarrassed that people should see his poverty on the first night of Yontif. All he has is a little piece of challah and a little piece of herring. That's his whole Siddur Yontif. So Pilz's father said, I was not any a bigger Balmidis than my friends were. Not at all. They were very fine people. And yet I observed that this elderly gentleman we were causing him anguish, and nobody else realized it. He said, you know why? Because I studied by the altar of Slobodka for a year and a half, 2 years. And this was the altar's thing. Don't sleepwalk your way through this world. Look at the totality and be aware of the totality. So he made us broaden our vision to take it all in, not to just get lost in the focus on one thing. And that's the reason I was aware of it. My chaverim were not aware of it. Because I had been under the tutelage of the Altar of Slobodka. And this was a major, major teaching of the altar. And something that he was very, you know, pushed strongly. To observe, be observant, to be aware of what's around us. And also not to be so overly focused on one thing that we forget about everything else. My chaverim once went, four of them, to speak to Rav Ruderman Zatzal, the Rosh Yeshiva of Neri Yisrael. And Rav Ruderman was also a Talmud of the Altar of Slobodka. So Rav Ruderman wanted to explain to them what the altar was about. So he told them the following story. Says, during the First World War, says, I was very frugal, and I managed to save money in the midst of the war. So I got together enough money that I'd saved, and I bought a very fancy telescope. Fancy tzitzis, high, well made, and whatever, venerable huder. And I came back with my telescope, and I came and I told the altar of Slobodka that in the midst of the war I was so frugal that I saved money, and I managed to put together enough money to buy a very fancy telescope. So what was the altar's reaction to me? He says, the altar wiped the floor with me. He says, what's with you? He says, in the middle of war, that's what crosses your mind to buy a fancy telescope. There are people, almonis, you say, people starving. They don't have a penny to eat. If you have an extra penny, extra few dollars, you give it away to somebody that they should have what to eat. They shouldn't starve to death in the middle of the war. He says, you need a telescope? And he says, you take an old undershirt, tear open the sides and put in tzitzis. You have a telescope. And he says, what in the world did you do? That was the altar. To realize everything that's involved. Don't, you have a very great idea, good. And how does it fit in with the rest of the world and everything else going on around you? You know, we sometimes get so possessed by our focus that we lose focus of everything else. So Elo is Baruch Hashem, we have a long time now, it's Labor Day past, it's a long time to Rosh Hashanah, it's a lot of time to gain focus. And what we need to start always is three points. It's where we have to start. Will we go after that? Who knows? But 3 points we always have to start. First and foremost, is to ask ourselves, when it comes to Torah, did I accomplish as much as I could have accomplished in the last year? No, we're not talking that, you know, I should have become the Godel Hador, the greatest Talmud Chacham in the last year's learning. That's, you know, that's not the issue. But the issue is that I used my time well. The time that I could have learned, that I could have learned. You know, there's a Musa Sefer called Chosen Yeshua, written by a Litvish Goyin of Yeshua Heller. And he says the following. It's a phenomenal, phenomenal insight, and one that has very, very real-time meaning. He says the following. He says, there are people in the world that their entire life is they learn. That's it. They're not involved in business and professions, whatever. There are such people in every generation that sit and learn. That's what they all they do. That's what they do in this world. Most of us is not what we do. Most of us, we are gainfully employed in whatever fashion to support our families. And then we try to use the rest of our time to learn that which is available. So there's a big difference between those two groups of people. So there's a person that learns all the time. So each hour has an hour's value. If he learned more, he learned less this hour, it has to do with this hour. The next hour is another hour. A person that has an hour or two a day to learn, and the rest of the day is in business, he has to be concerned with how his learning is leveraged. What do I mean by that, he says? Chazal tell us that if a person wanted to do a mitzvah, but he was unable to do the mitzvah because he was an oinus. There were factors beyond his control. So I told the Rebbe Shalom, yes, why didn't I learn a whole day? Very simple, I didn't learn a whole day. I have a family to support. I have to go to work. I have to earn a living. And it's a mitzvah to do so. So that's what I did. Sound answer. Accepted in heaven. They accept it. So now I come before the Rebbe Shalom and I said, listen, the 8 hours that I was in business, I want schar for Talmud Torah. Because if I hadn't been involved in that, this mitzvah, I would have been learning. So I want some schar for Talmud Torah. So he says, how do they judge me? He says, okay, I'll tell you what we'll do. What did you do on Sunday when you didn't go to business? How much of the day did you commit to learning? 25%, 50%, whatever. So that's the amount we'll pay you off for a whole week too. 25 or 50%. So he says, each hour that you learned is leveraged. Because if you learned, I learned 4 hours on Sunday, I'm going to get 4 hours credit every day of the week. I'm going to get 20 hours schar for those 4 hours. So the person, he says, that's not involved in learning all the time, how careful he has to be to use his time well. Because it's leveraged. And every percent that he has is going to get 5 days a week, that percent. It's a different story. Yes, what's involved, each hour is not an hour. Each hour is that hour plus another 5 hours in the week, and the rest of the day is Monday through Friday. So the question, he says, is what did I do when I had time to do? When I wasn't involved in my business, what did I do? That's the first thing we need to ask ourselves. And for most of us, the answer is this. You know, not everyone, as I said, can learn many hours a day. It's not for many people. They don't have the intellectual fortitude to be able to do so. It's not, they can't. But if we ask ourselves, could I have spent another 15 minutes or a half an hour a day learning? The answer probably is yes, I could have. But I just didn't. You know, as Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, that's how I was once asked by one of the people very close to him. He was a businessman. And he spent all the time that he wasn't working, he was very diligent in his learning. So we asked Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, should I retire and spend more time learning? So Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky said, tell me, do you want me to give a halachic answer or a practical answer? He says, if you want a halachic answer, so yeah, the halachic answer, you should retire and sit and learn all the time. He says, but the practical answer is the exact opposite. He says, now, he said, you use your time well. In business, you spend your time, you're involved in a mitzvah. Since you don't have a lot of time to learn, you use your time for learning well. You don't waste your time. So all your time is well used. You're using your life well. He says, are you going to retire? He says, I'll tell you what's going to happen. When you retire, he says, breakfast can take an hour now. You have time for another cup of coffee, another few pages in the newspaper. You know, life, what's the rush? So now you're not going to use your time well anymore. You're better off not retiring. You know, the insight of to use our time well. Tefillah. To strengthen ourselves in tefillah. To strengthen ourselves in tefillah. Tefillah, Chazal defined as avodah shebelev. The articulation of the words is a means only of arousing our inner feelings. But the essence of the tefillah is belief. Well, it's true, we're not yoytzei the mitzvah of tefillah if we don't articulate the words. But the reason to articulate the words is to arouse the kavanas halev. And I'll tell you a story. From Rav Volbo Zatzal, one of the great Balei Musar of the last generation. Rav Volbo was the mashgiach in a yeshiva. Right? So he was involved. His job was to provide the inspiration for people in yeshiva. So such a figure is usually a very saintly figure, and he's a very inspiring figure. And he was not coming, he did not daven mincha in yeshiva. So the Rosh Yeshiva came to him and asked him, it would be very inspirational that he daven mincha in yeshiva. So he heard the Rosh Hashanah, but he still didn't come to Mincha. This went on for a while. So finally the Rosh Hashanah came to his Rav Olbis. I don't understand. What's the big problem? You got to daven Mincha every day anyhow. So why don't you just daven in Yeshiva? What's the deal? You must obviously something is standing in your way. So what is it? So Rav Olbis told him the following. He said, in the winter time, I daven Mincha in Yeshiva. Why? The second Seder, the second study session, ends after the sun sets. So we daven Mincha before the second Seder in Yeshiva. So then I daven in Yeshiva. So we daven 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, whenever it is. It is in the winter, in the summertime, this is when we finish learning, the sun has yet to set. So we daven Mincha in Yeshiva after we complete the second Seder in Yeshiva. He says, I have a problem, he says. I daven at 7 o'clock in the morning, he says. I can't bear to wait another 12 hours to speak to the Rabbeinu Shel Olam again. So I have to daven someplace in the middle of the day, so I don't have to wait so long to speak to the Rabbeinu Shel Olam. And this, the Noda Behuda tells us, dictated, in fact, the structure of the tefillah. The Gemara says in Brochas, that one of the views, the Rambam seems to record both, is that the tefillahs are connected to karbonos tikkun. They correspond to the karbonos. So the Noda Behuda asked a very famous question, and that is, every time we say tefillahs musaf, we always mention the karbon. So if shachris and mincha are once connected to the tomid, are connected to tomid, so why don't we mention pashas tomid in Shmon Esrei every day? A very simple question. So the Noda Behuda answers, you know what? Because Rabbi Yochanan said, halavai, that a person should daven 1,000 times a day. To talk to the Rabbeinu Shel Olam constantly. He says, but if we mention the Korban Tomid, I would only be able to daven once, because I can't bring the Korban Tomid more than once. So of necessity, they had to omit the mention of the Korban Tomid from the Shmon Esrei to enable me to be able to daven as much as I want. So if you understand tefillah is our conversation with the Rabbeinu Shel Olam. You know, if they told us that we could call, you know, the Prime Minister of Israel, the President of the United States, you can call them every day, you know, twice a year you can call them. You have to call them at 9:25 and you can call them. So we'd be sure to be at the phone and we'd be excited with the opportunity. The Rabbeinu Shel Olam gives us the opportunity to speak to him. You know, I always marvel at the fact, in Shmon Esrei we say Baruch Atah. Atah is not distant, Atah is familiar. I speak to the version of you. You, Rabbeinu Shel Olam, you. Like I'm talking to the people across the other side of the table from me. How are you today? That's the way we're able to address the Rabbeinu Shel Olam. That's the gift of tefillah that the Rabbeinu Shel Olam has given us. As Hashem, another time we'll talk about Gemilas Chasadim.